Since revelations about China spying on the U.S. and then, of course, the bombing of the Chinese embassy during the Kosovo bombing, relations with China got pretty testy here for a while. Things seem to be normal. And I might add also that recent tensions between China and Taiwan kind of exacerbated the condition a bit. But things appear to be normalizing as China is getting the most favored nation status back. We are apparently still in talks about China's entry into the WTO. And generally, it is the impression you would get as you read about the various relationships that we have with China, political and economic, things are starting to normalize. But maybe I'm getting too optimistic, and let's find out where we're at and where we're headed. We have an opportunity now to discuss it because we're joined by Imran Anwar, founder of Imran Net Services in New York, pioneer of the Internet email in Pakistan, and, of course, a well-known media expert on India, Pakistan, and Asia. And with us now to talk about China. Hi, Imran.
Hello, George.
Well, am I right? Are things beginning to normalize between, for better or worse, and we can talk about that in a moment, but are things starting to normalize between the U.S. and China, or is it just a thin veneer at this point?
George, I think you're very right. Yes, of course, it's an optimistic point of view, but again, the fact that the planet is still around after maybe 200 years of people having pessimistic views suggests that in the long run, things still work out no matter what. So the optimistic point of view is not the wrong approach to take here. I fully agree with your perceptions. Things are beginning to thaw a little bit and move forward a little bit. That's simply because that's the reality of the global marketplace. Nobody can stay isolated for very long, and it's in everybody's interest to move forward. All they need to do is to make sure they make the sounds which suggest that they got what they wanted in the process.
Well, exactly. Of course, everybody does that. And as you say, it's in everybody's interest. Certainly the Chinese need us economically. Their trade with us is a major part of their economy. And the truth is that I suppose we have tremendous pressures to maintain economic relationships with them, most of it probably based on what we can expect to have as a marketplace in the future. Am I correct? And a lot of it based on also the fact that maybe U.S. corporations are in some way involved in Chinese business and industry, and some of that stuff that is coming over here from China is actually part of the profit is going to U.S. companies.
Absolutely, George. Yes to all of the above. Quite frankly, no matter what condition the U.S. economy is in general, it really means the whole world has to try to link to it and has to try to benefit from the linkages with the U.S. economy. And that applies whether you are all of Europe or whether you're China, whether you have a closed system or whether you have a liberalized economy. And that fact is not lost on anybody, no matter how heavily they go thumping their chests about U.S. imperialism and every time the U.S. may want or the West may want any country to open its doors to economic policy, etc. Now, yes, they need the U.S., but you're right, it's a two-way street. The reason it's in the U.S. interest to do business with China, of course, is twofold. We may always make it sound more focused on the first aspect, which is that if we have a liberalized economy there, one of the benefits will be a stronger process of democratization that will continue. And yes, that is part of a long-range benefit, but really in the short term, long term, basically, if there is such a word, the fact is economic benefits really accrue to both sides. And the American business, which also drives a lot of policy in these kinds of situations, has a lot to win if China continues to move forward in entering the WTO, for example, and especially if those doors are open more to the U.S. Than to other countries, especially Europe.
Well, let's talk a little about policy, though, because recently the S&P downgraded China. We know they cut rates. They're trying to reinflate their economy, and you and I have talked about it. Their economy is definitely fragile, to say the least, and they carry a huge amount of debt, their banks and so on, that would dwarf the problems that Japan has. and certainly the problems that we had with the SNL. So there, it's a fragile situation. And if the economy doesn't stay strong, then, of course, they have a fragile socio-political situation potentially. There are already, for China, very new conditions of dissent, religious dissent, and so on. Therefore, they have, but they're brilliant at putting up a face of strength. Now, recently, there were tensions between China and Taiwan and saber-rattling and so on, and some think that that could get away from us if we don't take a very strong position and make it very, very clear that we're not going to put up with any nonsense with Taiwan, and that we are willing to go to the mats over it militarily. That on the one side. The other side is that they are just ravaging us in terms of the trade deficit, in terms of trade policy, and so on. And again, because we have kind of a weak China policy. The overview is that we have some will say we have a weak China policy, and some will tell you that's the worst way to deal with China. You don't want to be, brink of war, but you don't want to be weak either. And I'm wondering what your assessment is. How would you assess the quality of our China policy between weak and aggressive?
That's an excellent assessment, George. And for our listeners who probably understand that I am not a member of any political party, I try to call it as I see it. And in particular with this administration, one of my biggest concerns has been whether Mr. Clinton was tied up with domestic issues or problems of his own making.
Right.
The fact of the matter is that the weak China policy is really, unfortunately, one in a series of weak policies. We have very weak policies about everything. We're very fortunate that the Balkan crisis was not averted as much as solved, and the solution continues. But in that, we were really lucky. It did not happen because we had a very clear, very well thought out, and very well spoken and outlined or executed strategy. It's just that the United States had strong military power, and the Europeans played along, and the competition, or the enemy in this case, did not have those resources. So things have worked out there, but again, that's not because we have some great leadership in place, unfortunately. The same thing applies to China. We have a weak China policy, and when we talk about a weak China policy, you can always create policy which can be based on making a conscious decision, we'll have a soft, a kid's glove approach to this country or that country. That is not weak policy. That may be wrong policy, but that can be policy based on choice. However, the problem I see with the situation right now is that our policy, which you refer to as weak policy, is really policy based on not really knowing what is the best way to do it. What do we really want to do? Should we go after them? Should we convey a message? There is no message coming from the United States leadership, and that is what countries around the world, whether they be Libya or Iraq or Milosevic or somebody in China, they will always exploit that message. It is when you are putting your foot down, whether it was Mr. Kennedy putting his foot down with Cuba and the Russians having to back down. Whatever you do, you have to have, whether you go to the brink of war or whether you take a totally hands-off approach while murder and looting continues, as happened in Bosnia for a while, or as continues in Kashmir, that if it's done by choice, at least your own people understand, at least the citizens of the United States understand where they stand and what their approach to the problem is. Our problem right now is nobody knows what's going on, and things happen, and then we react. We are not proactive, we are reactive, and that's the worst possible approach to take on with a country like China, or any country for that matter.
Well, let me ask about that. It's very difficult, whether we have a weak or strong policy with China is subjective in many ways, in terms of an assessment. And it seems to me that it is a difficult problem to deal with. I hear pundits who do have a political position, mostly on the conservative side at this point, making some fairly stiff criticisms of China policy. But it is my position that it's a lot easier for them to criticize the policy than it would be if they were in power to deal with it, because it's a very, very complicated equilibrium. Am I correct? We are following policies that certainly George Bush put into effect, and I think Ronald Reagan basically was following, that is active engagement. When they did the missile situation a year or so ago and rattled sabers, was a couple of years, whatever it was ago, that with Taiwan. We sent ships over there in the Taiwan Straits. I mean, we said this, you know, we made that clear that it was a no-nonsense thing. What should we be doing, I guess, is the question. You know, somebody says, well, don't give them most favored nation status, but the fact is, as you know, Imran, we have other countries in the world we deal with, A, who have spied on us, and we're spying on China, I doubt that I'm mistaken on that. We had Israel spying on us. We had the French spying on us at one time. We had huge deficits with Japan and so on, and we didn't stop most favored nation status with those countries. So I'm just saying, what is it that we're not doing that we ought to be doing? Because it seems to me it's one of those things you can make any case about it you want to make.
Absolutely, George. I totally agree with you there. But here's my contention, and I totally agree with you, because it's one of my pet peeves, is that one of the countries that gets billions of dollars in aid from us is one of the only known countries to have spies caught and being defended by the government of that country. But again, going back to China, my point is that I'm not saying that George Bush had any better policy or that Ronald Reagan had any better policy. I am not going by what the conservative pundits might be saying. My point of view is the following. When you are taking a stand, if it is based on a well thought out plan, and the message that you're conveying is very clear in your mind, and you can state that in two sentences or less to Congress or to the American people, then you can also state it in two sentences or less to whoever the engaging party is. Now, in the case of Taiwan, yes, there was saber rattling. Yes, we sent ships in. But did we leave with a clear message? Of course we did not, because otherwise this whole debate would not be starting again, with Taiwan being sort of threatened by China. The point I was trying to make is that you can have a very strong policy of peace, for example. So strong policy does not have to necessarily mean hawkish policy or warmongering policy. It just has to be very firm commitment to what you believe in, as opposed to changing based upon, well, what's our relationship there? Are we getting, you know, maybe there's political donations involved, maybe there are not. Obviously, the Republican side would like to hammer those points home.
Well, let me ask about that. I didn't mean to interrupt, but let me ask about something just to make sure I understand and the listeners understand where you're coming from here. How do you rate, because again, this is a very... It's a convoluted situation. It's subjective and it is fragile and so on, complicated. How do you rate the Clinton administration's China policy, say, against the Bush administration's China policy, roughly, just in the big picture? Because you did say that you weren't necessarily agreeing with the conservative pundits who criticize as though their administrations did a lot better.
Absolutely, that's a very good question. My point of view is that the Clinton administration actually lost some advantage that they could have hammered home with China. And then when scandals like the spying scandal and the alleged spying of nuclear secrets and the alleged financial sort of contributions to any particular election campaign, when things like that happen, you are less likely to be able to even follow through on what you yourself believe is the right thing to do. So even if you had been following the same policy as Mr. Bush, whether it was right or wrong, you have set yourself up in a position where you're hardly in a position to take a stand on principle, because you may have broken some principles on your own or looked the other way when things may or may not have happened. Perception is reality in this business, George. And I am suggesting that on the basis of what people see in the United States, that's what the perception is, among some people, of course. But what my point of view is that with a country like China, they will see that advantage to themselves even more clearly, even if none was intended from the Clinton administration. They will take advantage of any chink in the armor that they see, even more than the chink may be visible to the local policymakers or even the local population. And that is what my concern is, that if you do not make a firm stand on whatever the policy is going to be, and my personal opinion, because you had asked me earlier, was, yes, it has to be a very firm policy based upon, yes, we want to work with you economically, but it has to be on these certain conditions. And China, let's not forget, China is a communist society. China's model is not that much different from the Soviet Union's. And in the long run, especially if China is going to try to remain a military power, and especially if it's going to try to, like, use military force against Taiwan or other places, you will find that same level of breakdown internally from the lack of internal strong economic resources that led to the breakup of the Soviet Union. This could be a good thing. It could also be a bad thing.
Yeah.
So what we are looking to do is to help them economically, but let's not make them so strong with the economic benefits we provide, hoping for some few benefits 20 years down the road, but we provide them enough economic power that they can actually continue this aggressive approach to problems in their region, which will be a bigger problem for us 5 years from now, and forget about the potential advantages we may have 20 years down the road.
Well, you talk about subtleties. It is so difficult, as you know, once you start commercial interaction going, to control the amount of it, the degree of it, the quantity, but the quality of it, and we've never been successful at that. Let me ask this, though. When we are involved with China, should we separate political relationships as much as possible and the complications that arise from economic and commercial relationships? And which of the two at the moment should we be targeting as an area of concern when dealing with most concern when dealing with China?
Excellent question, George. I will have to give an answer as a comparison to another region just to show where I'm coming from. Let's say the Saudi Arabian government is the only nation on the planet mm-hmm. that has oil available that we need to continue economically surviving. The Saudis have rather harsh laws as far as dealing with women. Women don't have the same rights, for example. You know, women are not treated equally in any part of the world as far as I'm concerned. But let's say it's very strict there. Women cannot even go out driving on their own, let's say. Now, that's something that we, living in America, feel would be taking away the rights of women, etc., and we think it should be improved. But at the same time, we can turn a blind eye to that and say, right now, getting the oil and making sure we try to build relations with Saudi Arabia so they don't go into the Soviet camp if the Cold War was going on is more important. That can work. In the case of China, you have a country that is a strong military nuclear power that is directly threatening countries in its region and is also crushing its own internal dissent with armed force, not just a heavy-handed approach that, for example, the Iranians might have or the Saudis may have or the Libyans may have or some country in Latin America may have. No, we're talking about crushing student rebellions, crushing religious dissent, crushing countries across the streets. Now, those are issues that I think you cannot turn a blind eye to, not just because they are much worse crimes than the other countries might be committing, but because in the long run, a country which can do that to its own people and in its own neighborhood and has the capability and ICBMs and all these nuclear-capable weapons to target us is going to be a bigger problem to deal with down the road, and that is my concern.
So what do you do? Do you say to them, look, we don't like your civil rights record or your human rights record and approach, so therefore what?
Since they are as dependent on American help, so to speak, both in entering the WTO or also in getting most favored nation status or in continuing to make money off the American market, yes, we should be able to do that. Do American companies have incentives to do business with China? Yes, but the upside for the American companies may be 5 or 10 years down the road.
Mm-hmm.
The upside to China is today. It's cash in hand today. So we are in a better position to put our foot down and say, if you want this cash, we have this money, we have this market, you have these cheap or inexpensive goods that you want to sell here, we will let you do that, but in exchange, this is what we want you to do. And so in there, also make sure that you do it on diplomatic enough terms that your own business interests are not hampered 5 or 10 years down the road. But right now, they need us and our markets more than we need them.
But is it... What when they point back at us and say, first of all, world, I mean, and let's be honest, there's kind of an unspoken axiom of world policy that says whatever you do inside your own country is fine, but when it crosses over into borders, that's when we get nervous. So you know, people are reticent or countries are reticent to get involved if China just maintains whatever it's doing internally in the way of repression. That's one thing. The other thing is they'll say, look, you're dealing with various, and have in the past, Latin American countries that had repressive regimes, didn't bother you then. Taiwan has in the past been pointed out, it's certainly the democracy is much better now, but it had a fairly repressive, conservative regime at one time, so did South Korea. They can make a pretty, and not to mention the fact that we in our own times, in our own day, have had to do things internally to repress revolts of some kind or another. Some could make that case, it's made. So I'm just saying, when you get into this debate, how do you determine how much or to what degree somebody has the right to repress revolt against the laws and customs of their country before you don't do business with them anymore? You mentioned Saudi Arabia. I mean, those things get involved with, this is my culture, who are you to tell me?
Absolutely.
And this is
absolutely.
My religion, who do you tell me? I mean, you know what that is. So how do we balance that reality against wanting to see human rights improved in China and on the one side, and then the argument you've made also that the more we're involved, that active engagement kind of accelerates democracy and probably therefore better humanistic conditions.
Absolutely, George. 2 points here. I totally agree with your statement, because it basically reflects statements I have made myself on your show, is that yes, I take exception to hypocrisy in U.S. policy, but it's not something we haven't done before or do so on a regular basis. Number one. Number two, a country like Korea, Saudi Arabia, even Libya, does not have the capability to annihilate the population of the United States, as China does. Next, we are talking about helping these countries see the light, change things there, etc. But in their case, they need to sell oil. Let's say it was an oil shortage situation. The Saudis would find plenty of countries to buy oil from them without having to hear hear our preaching and sermons. In the case of China, we are in a position to provide them the markets that they need to gain the economic benefits, which may or may not actually find their way into the masses, of China, who do not have the rights to even ask to share in the wealth that might be created. So we in this position are it's almost like a seller's, a buyer's market here, and we are the biggest buyers. So we have that clout. In the case of the example with Russia, with Saudi Arabia, for example, it's a slightly different example. Does that mean it's not still slightly hypocritical? Of course it is. That's what, unfortunately, all policy generally ends up being. We tend to focus on problems that are more important to us.
Well, in other words, and we're out of time, in other words, it boils down to, because we've been accused of this in the past, a small country, we go rushing in there and try to deal with it militarily, but we wouldn't do that with the Soviet Union, wouldn't do it with China, we wouldn't do it with some other country, get away with the same thing. It boils down to, you fix what you can, and you deal with each country separately, and if a small country is no threat, you might do business with them if they have a certain kind of a human rights condition. But if China is a threat, then you have to take a different approach. In other words, international policy is almost by definition a bit hypocritical.
Absolutely, George. But let's also remember that in this case, again, they need our markets to make the money that they can use to improve the standard of living and the rights of the people that live in that country. So let's not lose that opportunity.
We'll talk more about it, Imran, but thank you much for joining us today. As always, a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Imran Anwar, founder of Imran Net Services in New York, pioneer of Internet email in Pakistan, and, of course, a media expert on India, Pakistan, and Asia.